Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day and happy Easter, if that's your jam. I'm Mark Kenny, and thanks for joining us again on ANU's Democracy Sausage, a weekly program which looks at politics, policy and ideas, both nationally and abroad. We'll have a look at the Liberal Party crisis in future weeks, but today we're going to be talking about submarines and AUKUS and sovereignty and nuclear power and a whole lot of issues around that. We're going to be doing that with Rex Patrick. But first, before I do that, let me bring in Maria Tafflaga, Dr. Maria Tafflaga, a political scientist at the School of Politics and International Relations, with whom you are no doubt very familiar because she's on this podcast virtually every week. Maria, we can't just ignore the earthquake that happened on the weekend. It was astonishing to see a 102-year-old, 103-year-old record of a government, no government, increasing its majority between elections by way of by-election, suddenly broken.
Yeah, I mean, whenever these records fall, it's always a big deal. I mean, I think the Aston by-election is kind of an interesting case in terms of, I suppose, the sort of specifics around that particular electorate with the previous member. But when you kind of look at the sort of swing to the against the Liberal Party at the 22 election, they lost 7% of their vote and now another 6 on top.
Mm.
You know,
this is in Aston, you mean?
Yes, in Aston. Yeah. I think it's whilst there are special circumstances, you know, Victoria being, you know, not a good state for the Conservatives, it is hard not to sort of think or to sit up and to kind of consider that there is a really important signal in this by-election, even if, you know, I'm a bit wary about over-interpreting by-elections because I think voters sort of understand that the stakes are different. You know, it's not a government that's up for re-election. You know, it's a chance to sort of make a point or have a message or vote for a candidate you like. So this is my way of, I'm having a bet each way. It's what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's fair enough. I was certainly asked about it in a few radio interviews and so forth before the election, before the by-election, and I made the point that, you know, there'd been this strong swing against the Liberal Party at the 2022 election. At that time, Alan Tudge was the candidate. He was an unpopular figure, quite sort of had been in the news for all the wrong reasons for a period of time. And, of course, Scott Morrison was the Prime Minister and he was profoundly unpopular as well, as was the government. So my argument was, look, there's a record here that is more than 100 years old and there's a swing that's already happened. Neither of those two characters are on the ballot paper, neither Tudge nor Morrison. You would have thought in those circumstances there might be some sort of drift back to the party. And in fact, what we saw voters do was say, no, we want to put an exclamation mark on the decision we made last time and we're not having any of it. And it really, really was quite extraordinary. And, you know, there's a lot of soul searching now that has to be done by the Liberal Party in terms of whether its base is in sort of terminal decline, you know, baby boomers getting older and going out of the picture, younger voters coming in, looking at the Liberal Party and what it seems to stand for, or perhaps more accurately, what it emphatically seems to stand against rather than what it's for. We've seen people like Tony Barry, the Liberal Party insider and strategist, a very, very keen observer of these things, says the situation will get worse before it gets worse for the Liberal Party. Cos Samara. Yeah. Sorry?
It'll get worse before it gets better.
No, he said it will get worse before it gets worse.
Those were his
actual words. And Cos Samaras, the Labor-aligned strategist and analyst of numbers and demographics and markets and so forth, he sort of predicted that if the Liberals, as it looks like they're going to do, line up against The Voice, that it's going to be potentially catastrophic for them. I think that was the term he used. So,
yeah, I can see that being really bad for them in a state like Victoria. It's definitely an important watershed moment. But I guess some of my skepticism comes from the fact that we've often had surprising by-election results and then, you know, the election comes and the seat swings again. So what I'm saying is that they're very noisy results and, you know, you probably really want to look at the specific factors in that sort of seat or what's going on there to try to sort of truly understand them. We should be a bit reluctant to extrapolate too much from them. However, I do agree with everything you've sort of said, and the moderates have sort of are attempting to use this to strengthen their position within the federal party, right? And within their various state branches, because they've all just sort of had election defeats. I guess for me, what is sort of interesting is whether or not that actually has any traction because the people who hold seats, who hold power and resources, who can distribute them, are typically now not moderate. Not from that faction. And the analysis out of the New South Wales election was, I thought, interesting, where essentially the claim was made that, you know, I think you said this, Mark, people wanted a Labor government. They didn't want a Labor government. They didn't want a left-wing government. That's why they threw Perrottet out and voted in a Labor government. There's a deeper sort of structural issue at play in this political party, and political parties are extremely adaptive. You know, like they reinvent themselves all the time. What is, I think, the most interesting question about the Liberal Party right now is whether or not they reinvent themselves and readapt into the same structure they are in, or if they morph into more than one structure.
Yeah, well, there's this live debate at the moment about whether they should stick to their so-called values, whatever that means, pretty ill-defined term, stick to their positions, or whether they should shift to the centre. And some people are saying, well, you shift to the centre, you become a paler version of the Labor Party. How does that advantage you? Well, it strikes me the answer to that is, well, do you want to be a party of government or do you want to be a party of the fringe? If you want to be a party of the fringe and say, look, these are our values, that's fine, but don't pretend you're going to have enough numbers to court what you need to put together a majority and become a government. Just I'm going to bring in Rex on this because he's been in politics and we'll have some observations on this as well. But just on the seat of Aston, let's not forget, I mean, yes, there's a strong Chinese population. It's actually a bit less multicultural than a lot of other seats. And if we think back to Peter Dutton's rather curious speech on taking over as opposition leader after the election. He didn't do the traditional thing of acknowledging the message from voters, of promising to revisit a number of the policies that the Morrison government had taken to the election. He instead talked about surrendering those teal seats and actually rebuilding the Liberal Party in the outer suburban mortgage belt seats where he thought the Liberal Party could make up ground. Now, that is exactly the kind of seat that Aston is. And at the very first opportunity for that strategy to work, it has spectacularly failed. I don't think there's no sort of polishing that particular.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But I guess, I Aston's been in the Liberal Party fold for a long time now, 20 years. And I guess that's actually the question. Who is Dutton talking about? Is he talking about that kind of voter? He probably is. But I think he's also got his sights on what he kind of sees as the conservative sort of fraying edge of Labor's base, the sort of non-cosmopolitan Labor voters. Mm. But whether or not that that, like, I mean, look, this is what's important to understand is that what is happening in the Liberal Party now is part of a long-running process, a process that was started like 30 years ago. And it worked really well for them for a certain time. They were able to extract, they were able to keep their votes whilst actually not really delivering for them, especially rhetorically and over time in policy terms. And then and basically pull off conservative non-cosmopolitan voters from Labor, and you know that gave them a majority, and they governed for a long time, and now the bottom's fallen out of that strategy.
The bottom has fallen out of that strategy. Now, look, let's bring in our guest Rex Patrick. He's a former South Australian senator, Centre Alliance senator, and independent, I think, as well, and is also a former submariner. And we're going to be talking to him mostly about submarines. But Rex, any thoughts on what we've just been discussing?
Yeah, look, I think that the Liberal Party had a turning point back in 2019 where Malcolm Turnbull was trying to address climate change in a conservative manner through
2018, I think you mean.
Sorry. Yeah. When he was trying to address the NEG or the energy situation we had as a climate change measure, he was after something that provided reliability, low cost and clean energy, and Peter Dutton stepped in and said, no, this is not going to happen. That caused, of course, a leadership spill. And ever since that time, the Liberal Party has sat, you know, to the right of centre, and the electorate is more central. And given the choice between voting for a Labor Party, which might be a little bit left of what might normally be comfortable, most moderate liberals will do that in preference to voting a liberal party that is directed towards the right of politics. I think Malcolm Turnbull might have got the story right when he described on the weekend how, you know, sky after dark is a beacon drawing the Liberal Party to the right, which is actually towards the rocks.
Yes.
Upon which they will sink, and there does need to be some change, recognizing that, you know, people who are right wing would prefer to vote for a moderate Liberal Party than they would for the Labor Party, so they can catch both the central vote and the right wing vote.
Yeah, that's right, and it's a very good point about the sky after dark thing. One certainly been made before. I've certainly made it, and others have as well. But just the sort of that siren call of all these, you know, sort of self-styled heroes, you know, foghorns on sky late at night or you know after dark, as it's described. These people are heroes in the sense that they don't stand for election themselves. They don't have to put together majorities themselves or actually be accountable for these positions, and yet they speak with great certainty about where the Liberal Party's soul is, where its future is, what its values should be. And they provide this sort of nightly applause for the more conservative members of the Liberal Party. So the more right-wing you are, the more likely you are to be on there and be getting the applause of Paul Murray and Rowan Dean and all these characters. That isn't where Australian voters are. This is just a sort of a kind of a fanatical cabal, really, of zealots, really, and they're not particularly well connected.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rex's description of the electoral arithmetic is spot on, right? Like the poll is being pulled further and further to the right. So what is considered moderate in that institution, especially when they're losing alternative and contesting voices, means that it actually is quite a challenge for the Liberal Party to move back towards the centre. There's really two ways to do it. One is to get a leader that is more centrist, that can convince everyone to be disciplined. We've seen that model fail a few times now. Another is to actually get moderates elected. There are some major challenges. Parties are adaptable. Governments get old and tired. But, you know,
branch stacking being one of them. I mean, the sort of entryism in the Liberal Party by religious group, yeah. you know, religious fanatics and so forth has really changed the rank and file of the Liberal Party as well. So it is a sort of a subset of the population which is ideologically far more conservative than the ordinary citizen. And we see this in things like support for The Voice or in the sort of casual and widespread support for marriage equality back in 2017. And the Liberal Party isn't reading any of these social trends, you know, these new voters coming in, these people who aren't, you know, prosecuting culture wars and foaming at the mouth about, you know, biblical things.
To apply some real politic to it, right? Like, what is inspiring about being a moderate? It's not like a rallying call, right? No. And I know that's a glib point, but all of that energy has shifted into the Teals campaigns,
yeah.
you know. So what are the moderates actually going to be able to attract people to the Liberal Party now that their capacity to offer patronage is diminishing? You know, it's still fairly stable in New South Wales comparatively, but in Victoria and everywhere else, it's on the decline. And so that
going well in Queensland.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, not necessarily for it's dominated
not
by the
for
LNP,
the moderates,
right?
Yeah, that's LNP.
That energy has to go somewhere because lots of people, as Rex said, would prefer to vote for a centre-right party than the Labor Party. So that energy's got to go somewhere. Is it going to be rechanneled back into the Liberal Party or is it going to be channeled somewhere else? But it's not going away.
The obvious thing, Rex, for Dutton to have done, and he had the perfect cover for doing it, and no doubt a great deal of license as a known right-wing figure, a known conservative figure, would have been to accept the end of the climate wars as declared by voters in the election. So he could have, and he had, as I say, the perfect cover, because what Labor put up was an updated and uprated version of coalition existing mechanism, you know, the safeguards mechanism. Labor increased it towards getting its 43%. Dutton could have easily at that point said, well, you know, I mean, we've heard the voters. This thing's been going on for too long. This is the mechanism we want. They could have dealt themselves into negotiations if they wanted to argue, for example, that the transition was too fast, that it had disadvantageous effects in sections of the economy. They could have been in that negotiation. Instead, that negotiation occurred between Labor and the Greens. And what changes there were made to what Labor was proposing took the final package arguably to the left. So Dutton's been very cumbersome, it seems to me, on this. He had that would have given him a lot of leeway, I think, a lot of credibility to be able to argue that he's not just a no-elition leader, he's a coalition leader. Your thoughts?
Well, I'll just weigh in there and say that I think that Peter Dutton lacked vision back in the day where he rejected the NEG. That was a perfect opportunity for the Liberal Party to sit in a moderate position and achieve some outcomes. And now that we've seen climate change playing out through elections and the clear indication that that's what the electorate wants, he's no longer a leader without vision. He's just a leader that doesn't actually recognise what's going on.
Yes, well, we will talk about this no doubt more. Let's go to what it was that we initially got you on here for, because we've talked about getting you back. It was terrific to talk to you last time about submarines and naval policy and, you know, those sort of defence questions. And, of course, in the intervening period, we've had the AUKUS announcement, the three leaders, Biden, Sunak and Albanese, standing there in the US releasing the details. What's your overall, what's your assessment now that you know those details?
Well, I just want to frame up the environment for the conversation first, and that is to say that back in 2009, where the submarine project was first announced, we had a Rudd-Gillard-Rudd government pushing for a Son of Collins, that is an Australian-designed submarine. We changed then to Abbott, who pushed a Japanese submarine. Then we changed again to Turnbull, who made a decision to go down the French path. And then we saw Morrison and now Albanese kick in behind a US and a British submarine. So I just want to put some caution out there as to the finality of this particular announcement.
Oh, dear.
You know, the reality is that governments can only control things whilst they're in government. You know, I point out that the 2040 date that we're supposed to be building an AUKUS British designed submarine, at that point in time, Anthony Albanese will be 77. And you and I will be reading the second edition of his memoirs that we've taken from a discount bin in a bookstore. You know, that's the reality of the situation. So just got to be very careful about, you know, thinking that this is the final answer. You know, I've lived through announcements in relation to continuous naval shipbuilding that were then followed by valleys of death where people were laid off because the intended pathway didn't actually eventuate. And I actually think there's a huge, you know, problem moving forward for Mr. Albanese and following governments in relation to this particular project with respect to cost and with respect to risk. I will just go firstly to the point about, you know, the details being announced by the three leaders in San Diego. Well, I just want to say that the reality is that there was very little detail rolled out in relation to exactly what's happening. It was in some sense a media show. There are now, I think, about 9 fact sheets on the Defense Department's website, and that's what we have as a result of $300 million being spent over the last 2 years exploring this particular proposal. You know, the details are simply not there. We've got one page on nuclear stewardship. We've got one page on spent fuel waste. There isn't a lot of detail. And in actual fact, what's happened here, and we're now seeing you know, people from the Labor Party coming out and expressing this view, is that this whole thing has been kept completely under wraps and then presented as a fait accompli. And there has been no debate. And, you know, that's hugely problematic.
Maria, do you think one of the problems with that, I mean, those are all exceptional points to consider, and do you think one of the problems there, if we think about the kind of political institutional machinery into which this decision lands, one of the problems is that there's unanimity across both sides of politics on this, which is a perfect situation for not having a great deal of scrutiny, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
I mean, Labor's picked up Scott Morrison's AUKUS plan. You know, I've seen people say, and you know, they've designed it brilliantly, is the way it was put by at least one fan I read of. But, you know, with both sides effectively owning this, as Rex says, there's not a lot of detail yet, but not much clamour for it either.
No, and I think that highlights where I think a lot of defence and security legislation and spending kind of ends up.
Yes, very
you know,
good point.
It hasn't, you know, this space hasn't been contested now for in a really kind of, I guess, front of mind way for many decades. And that's in part because of the way it's been used for political purposes to essentially paint Labor as soft on whatever it is that they're soft on, and for the coalition to reaffirm their sort of issue ownership over defence and security. But I guess something I'd actually like to ask Rex, because I really don't know, is what alternative did Labor really kind of have since, you know, now that deal has been sort of signed, given that it is with our sort of important strategic partners, I guess first order strategic partners might be the way I'd put it. And also I can see that even if people don't like it within the Labor caucus and don't like it within the cabinet room, realistically, where could they go? I mean, is that actually really an option? For an alternative?
It's interesting to go back to September the 16th, 2021, when AUKUS was originally announced by Scott Morrison. Anthony Albanese was given a 24-hour sort of briefing period notice in relation to this particular decision. He was running a small target strategy in the lead up to the election, and so he simply came out supporting what Morrison was doing for exactly the reasons you've mentioned, Maria. He didn't want to create some differentiation between Labor and Liberal on defence. There was a huge opportunity when he took over the running of the show for him to examine this, to examine it from a cost perspective, to examine all of the details, and to then turn around and say, look, this is not going to suit us. You know, whilst it is, you know, portrayed as special that we've been offered this capability, the reality is during the Cold War, other European nations were offered nuclear capabilities for their submarines, but declined on the basis of extraordinary cost. You know, one of my big concerns here, notwithstanding that we've got a $100 billion contingency on this particular project, you know, the government saying it's going to cost from between $268 and $368 billion. I mean, who after a couple of years of detailed study comes up with $100 billion in movement on price? I don't know how that works. But the huge cost associated with this, in the context of things like stage three tax cuts, which are going to reduce our revenue base, in the context of predictions in terms of mineral exports or fossil fuel exports, we've seen just in the last couple of days predictions that our export generation will drop by something of the order of $159 billion across coal, gas, and iron ore. I mean, how are we going to pay for this? Even in the short term, Albanese has indicated that across the Ford estimates, there's no change in relation to spending because there was $6 billion that had been allocated for the French submarine, and they're going to try and find $3 billion in savings. In circumstances where they're trying to deal with an increasingly uncertain situation to our north, the idea that you're going to cut expenditure in the short term to deal with a submarine that arrives in a decade's time is just mind-blowingly absurd. So there's a whole bunch of problems with this. It just, to me, hasn't been thought through and hasn't been debated properly because of that secrecy that I referred to before.
Yes, one wonders whether the sort of disconnect between the decisions and the accountability for those decisions exposes defence as a policy area to so much of this a kind of announcement waiting. You know, the political credit is in the announcement. The outcome of those announcements is so far down the track so often. They can be quite catastrophic in price terms and capability terms, but that's for another day. Let's take a very quick break and we'll be back in just a moment.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage. We're talking with Senator Rex Patrick, or former Senator Rex Patrick, I should say. In America, of course, Rex, you'd continue to own that term for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, you don't get to do that here.
Very, very happy with the word Rex.
Now,
which, of course, is Latin for king. So
is it? Yes.
It might even sit above Senator. So
good point.
Good.
Yes, right. King Patrick. Nice. Okay. Well, look, let's go to we've been talking about, you know, this in sort of general terms. Let's go to some more specific questions about this thing, the nuclear capability. Do we need a nuclear submarines? We're not talking about nuclear armed, I should hasten to add. We're talking about nuclear powered, and we're talking about this initial plan would be to acquire some of these Virginia-class submarines, 2, 3, up to 5. Some of those will be stationed here initially as part of the US fleet from, I think, 2027. And by about 2032, 33, we will be owning a couple of them and possibly more. And then the British AUKUS, SSN AUKUS, that comes in the 2040s, and there are supposedly eight of them. And between all of this, we get, you know, the involvement of the US, we get the partnership with the UK, we get two different platforms, both of them to be nuclear.
If you buy in the next 10 minutes, they'll throw in.
Yeah, it does feel like it's got a lot of moving parts, and it will result in potentially three platforms being operational at once. No one's even really denying that. That's not the intention, because it's just possible that we'll still have the conventional Collins, extended life Collins class, as well as the Virginia class, and perhaps the first of the British Astute class, or AUKUS SSN as it's going to be called. Do we need nuclear for capability, Rex?
Look, I think this question is best asked by, you know, suggesting that the best kind of car is a Ferrari. Now, there are some people who would just instantly sort of have an affinity with that idea. They are good cars. They're fast. They look good. But actually, when you want to go shopping with them, with a family, they're not very good. If you want to tow a caravan, they're not very good. So it all comes down to the question, what do you intend to do with these submarines? That's the fundamental question that needs to be asked. And there are lots and lots of things that submarines can do, you know, from intelligence gathering through to mine laying through to inserting special forces covertly, conducting land attack, taking out other submarines, taking out other surface vessels. Each of the different types of submarines, both the older conventional submarines, the new air-independent propulsion submarines, and nuclear-powered submarines, can do all of those jobs. And there are pros and cons for each type of those submarines when they go about doing that. And I'll just give you some good examples. So the nuclear submarine, and as you know, I've been to sea on nuclear submarines. I've spent time at sea on a couple of occasions on USS Santa Fe, the predecessor to the Virginia class. Nuclear submarines are great if you want to go down to a couple hundred metres, crank the speed up to 30-odd knots and stay there so that you can go long distances and arrive in a distant area in a relatively short period of time. They're also very good for being able to get out of trouble when you fire a Tomahawk missiles, for example. Most people would not necessarily appreciate, although it will be obvious once I tell you this. Once you fire something like a Tomahawk missile, there's this huge white smoke trail that an anti-submarine warfare force can just follow back to where the submarine was. So, you know, the ability to fire off some Tomahawk missiles and then to get out of the area quickly on a nuclear-powered submarine is a great capability. However, there are times where you would rather have a conventional or an AIP, air independent propulsion submarine. They tend to be smaller. They're better at operating in shallower water areas. They can get closer inshore to insert special forces, although, again, they can't carry as many special forces as a larger nuclear-powered submarine. In general, they are quieter when they are operating either on batteries or something like a fuel cell than a nuclear-powered submarine. So a nuclear-powered submarine always has to have the cooling pumps running to the reactor. The reactor itself is simply an energy source to heat water to drive a steam turbine. So, us submariners refer to it as the kettle. That's it produces steam that drives a very large steam turbine that might be spinning at, let's say, about 3,000 RPM, that has to connect to a propeller that might be spinning at 50 RPM, and as a result, you end up with the need for reduction gears. Gears involve metal parts meshing together. It's impossible to make them completely quiet. There are aspects about a nuclear submarine that make it noisier than a submarine that simply runs off batteries and an electric motor. You know, of course, if a conventional submarine operates for any sort of reasonable period of time, and typically at least once a day, it will have to come up to the surface, stick up a snorkel mast and run diesels to recharge batteries. That makes it extremely vulnerable in a highly contested area. But, of course, the new air-independent propulsion submarines can actually also stay underwater for a couple of weeks without the need to snorkel. And, again, I've actually been to sea on a Greek and South Korean Type 214 submarines that have hydrogen fuel cells, and so I know those capabilities quite well. So it really comes down to what is it you're trying to do with these things. And look, my fear in relation to this is that it's that high transit speed, the ability for a submarine to go from Perth up into the South China Sea in a relatively short period of time is the actual driving factor behind this type of submarine for Australia. And what worries me about that is that in all instances, particularly in relation to a $368 billion defence program that puts all of your eggs into one basket, we should always be focusing first and foremost on defence of Australia. That doesn't require a nuclear-powered submarine. We should have a whole range of other capabilities. Just imagine what you can buy with $368 billion, which would include, you know, 20 or 30 conventional submarines, a whole bunch of other capability, industry resilience, fuel security, perhaps an Australian flagged merchant fleet, a whole range of other things that can be funded in relation to defence of Australia. And the idea being, when we want to contribute to any particular operations as a coalition or as an ally to the US, we take those assets that we have acquired for Defence of Australia and we utilise those. We don't specifically design our Defence Force around the need to operate with a coalition in a distant place.
Well, look... You will be familiar with this because I know you are. But this goes to the question now of the British submarines and the arrangement we've entered into to manufacture them significantly in your state of South Australia at Osborne. Although there have been some doubts expressed about how much of the work will end up in Australia and how much it will be retained by the British, but. Very disturbing to read the comments of Rear Admiral Philip Matthias, retired. He's the former Director of Nuclear Policy in 2005 to 2008 in Britain. So he's a pretty qualified sort of authority. He says that, you know, we're going down the wrong path, particularly in respect of the British new SSN AUKUS. He says, building nuclear submarines is a hugely complex engineering challenge. Britain barely has sufficient skills or effective high-level leadership to deliver its own program, let alone Australia's, which has no expertise. Since the creation of the Director General Nuclear Post in 2016 and the Submarine Delivery Agency in 2018, attack submarines HMAS Audacious and Anson have been delivered late by BAE Systems. The in-service date of the first new deterrent submarine HMS Dreadnought has been delayed from 2024 to the 2030s, and HMS Vanguard's refit by Barrett has taken 7 years and is still not complete. We have also yet to decommission a single one of our 22, or dismantle a single one of our 22 decommissioned nuclear submarines, which is a national disgrace. This is hardly inspiring confidence about the likelihood of this highly complex contract actually delivering in the way that we're being told it will.
It's really strange. Look, if you just accept, and I don't, but if you accept that we need a nuclear-powered submarine, going to the United States and saying, look, can you help us spin up our expertise here by basing a few submarines out here first, and then we'll get one of your off-the-shelf proven Virginia-class submarines, and then we'll get a few more. why would you then, having gone down that particular pathway, and noting the comments you made before, Mark, about the complexity in operating several different types of submarines, having got yourself some Virginia-class submarines, why would you jump off that particular path to a highly risky British-designed submarine? And as you've said, the astute submarines that they operate right now, the nuclear attack submarines of the British or the Royal Navy, were significantly late and significantly over budget. The Dreadnought program, again, is late. And as you've pointed out, we've got a situation where the Brits haven't decommissioned any of their 22 retired submarines. HMS Dreadnought, which was their first ever nuclear-powered submarine, was commissioned 60 years ago. It served for 17 years, and for the last 43 years has sat alongside in the UK, and they still have not dismantled that submarine yet. I mean, this is just a bizarre place to go to get a future capability. Now, I suspect the reason that that's occurred is that there's nothing that the US defense industry will defend more than the United States than their own industry. And I, you know, the idea you go to the US and get some Virginia-class submarines, again, that's a safe option. And I'm sure it was probably proposed that we could become the third Virginia-class production yard in the United States. They have two yards at the moment that are not meeting the demand of the US Navy. We could have potentially said, look, let's have the third yard in Adelaide for both Australian and other US submarines, but I don't think US industry would have permitted that. Mm. They're very, very strong. And so the government went looking for a political solution, and that is this sort of submarine with all sorts of knobs on it, and that is the British AUKUS submarine. It's just extremely risky. And my view is, and noting what I said about the changes that occur with these programs as a function of a change of prime minister and the fact that Albanese will not be around when this particular program sort of starts to get real legs, I don't think we'll ever go down that path. I think what will happen is that we will continue with the Collins-class submarines. The Navy's own plan shows that they will retire in 2043. If I work back from 2043, noting that full cycle dockings for Collins-class submarines and the life of type extension gives them an extra 10 years life, I think the last full cycle docking will occur in about 2033, which is the time in which the first Virginia-class submarine is arriving. When that first Virginia-class submarine arrives, we simply won't have the crews to man that submarine without retiring a Collins-class submarine. We won't have the money to continue to do full-cycle dockings and life-of-type extensions. So it's my view that the work in Adelaide will stop around 2033. We'll then see what people might describe as a valley. I would say it will be a cliff. We'll see no work being carried out in Adelaide from about 2033 onwards, and who in their right mind would then try and rebuild a workforce in South Australia to embark on a risky British submarine-designed program? I think if we end up going with the British, they'll end up being built in the UK, but I actually think at some stage some sensible government will simply say, let's stick with the Virginias.
Yeah, that's quite a prediction.
Yeah, yeah. I have a couple of questions, and they're all fairly naive. Are the British submarines more risky than the Japanese or the French ones? Like, do you actually know?
Look, the British have had a history of delays in their programs and technical problems in their programs. We know the Japanese are highly reliable in terms of when they make a commitment to deliver a submarine, that they will, in fact, deliver it. So there, that's a chalk and cheese example. Of course,
well, you could be talking about cars there as well. I mean, you know, the yeah, British. Leyland, what do you want? What do you want when it's raining? A British car or a Japanese one?
So they say that the British cars are interesting and the Japanese ones are reliable. So,
yes.
We could go to a reputable supplier of conventional submarines, and this has been my push since 2009. Go and buy 20 off the shelf design submarines, build them in Adelaide. When you think about an operational commander trying to deal with the Australian Defence Force when there are 20 submarines that they have to think about in 20 different locations versus 8. Perhaps slightly more capable submarines in 8 different locations. I think the former is a bigger sort of problem for the anti-submarine warfare commander. So, again, no one has talked about our needs. No one has talked about why it is that we're going down this particular pathway. The debate just hasn't happened. I think that they should have looked more closely at the alternatives, such as either the Japanese or indeed a German or a French off-the-shelf submarine.
And the funny thing about the French thing was that we actually were down-specking their nuclear submarine to build a French conventional version of it.
Old defence always finds the hardest way to do things. What was almost a proven design, so one from a manufacturer that had heritage in respect of designing submarines, that were building the Barracuda class submarines, their nuclear powered submarines, and we said, let's take the reactor out and replace it with a diesel and a battery. It's kind of like saying to an electric car manufacturer, let's just take out the electric components of it and we'll just put back into it a diesel engine, and by the way, we're the only customer that's going to do that, so we're going to bear all the cost for that. When it's just defense, just look, I want to be really respectful to people in uniform. I think they do a great job on the front line. I served in the Royal Australian Navy. They're all really, really professional people, but then they make their way to the top of the tree and they. They run these sorts of projects and they have very little experience in that space. Just as I wouldn't take a project manager and say, right, I'm going to make you a submarine captain, I wouldn't take a submarine captain and say, I'm going to make you a project manager. That's not being disrespectful. That's just the reality of it. And we have all these generals and admirals and air marshals making decisions or recommendations about projects when they have very little experience in project risk, and they're making those recommendations to cabinet ministers who have no idea about project risk. It's just a recipe for disaster, and that's why we continuously see defence projects going off the rails.
Rex, it's been absolutely terrific. I know you might have had another question, Maria, but I think we're actually very close to our maximum time. So, it's been terrific having you on again, Rex, to talk about all of these issues. We didn't even really get to the question of dealing with the nuclear waste, dealing with these reactors once they get to their end of life. We'll have to talk about that another time because that also is an issue that will have some very prickly political aspects to it, and it'll be around a lot longer than the memoirs of the reprinted memoirs of Anthony Albanese or anyone else, thousands and thousands of years potentially for weapons grade nuclear waste in the case of the Virginia class in particular. Thanks, Rex. Really, really terrific discussion.
Happy to have engaged.
And thank you, Maria.
My pleasure, and thank you again, Rex.
And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email address, which is democracysausage@anu.edu.au. That is democracysausage@anu.edu.au. And we're always keen for your feedback. So until then, bye for now.
Bye.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.